This is Lover Alternative News. I'm Jim Burr. Surviving partner of September 11th victim testifies before Senate subcommittee hearing on banning same-sex civil marriage rights. Fighting back tears before a Senate subcommittee this afternoon, Keith Bredkowski, who lost his partner of 11 years, Jeff Coleman, in the September 11th attacks, gave testimony at a hearing on the legal viability of the 1996 Anti-Gay Defense of Marriage Act. Bredkowski said that without the rights and protections of a civil marriage license, same-sex couples are left vulnerable where most other Americans are not. My name is Keith Bredkowski and I am a resident of California. I've been a registered nurse since 1983 and have worked for many years in hospital administration. It was on a Tuesday, almost exactly 2 years ago, that I received a call from American Airlines notifying me that I had lost my life partner, Jeff Coleman. Jeff was an American Airlines flight attendant who volunteered to work an extra trip on September 11th. His flight was the first of four planes hijacked by terrorists that day. I know in my heart Jeff died with courage, trying to protect the passengers and crew. The last time I spoke with Jeff, who was my soulmate 11 years, was at about 2 a.m. Boston time on the morning of the 11th. He had awoken in the middle of the night and uncharacteristically called me to say, "I love you and can't wait to get home." I believe he must have had some premonition of the events to come, and I feel blessed to have had that last moment with him. Jeff was the ultimate caregiver. I experienced his caring by the trail of post-it notes he left for me every time he went on a trip. His last note, still on my bathroom mirror, greets me every morning with a, "Guess who loves you?" Jeff and I had exchanged rings and we were married in our hearts. Legally, it was another matter entirely. After his death, I was faced not only with my grief over losing Jeff, who was indeed my better half, but with the painful task of proving the authenticity of our relationship over and over again. With no marriage license to prove our relationship existed, even something as fundamental as obtaining his death certificate became a monumental task. And that was just the beginning. During the years we were together, Jeff paid taxes and had Social Security deducted from his paycheck like all other Americans do. But without a civil marriage license, I am denied benefits that married couples and their families receive as a matter of routine. Jeff died without a will, which meant that while I dealt with losing him, I also had huge anxiety about maintaining the home we shared together. Without a marriage license to prove I was Jeff's next of kin, even inheriting basic household possessions became a legal nightmare. Married couples have a legal safety net of rights and protection that gay Americans are currently denied. Until Jeff died, I had no idea just how vulnerable we were. Where married couples have security and protection, gay couples are left without a net. Like so many other gay Americans, my mourning and grief were compounded by the stress and anxiety of horrific legal uncertainty and confusion. The terrorists who attacked this country killed people not because they were gay or straight, but because they were Americans. It is heart-wrenching that our government does not protect its citizens equally, gay and straight, simply because they are Americans. 2 years ago, we were all united against the common threat of terrorism. Now, less than 2 years later, I am sitting here and being told that my relationship was a threat to our country. Jeff and I only sought to love and take care of each other. I do not understand why that is a threat to some people, and I cannot understand why the leaders of this country would hold a hearing on the best way to prevent that from happening. In closing, I would like to read an excerpt from a letter that Jeff wrote to me on our last anniversary. "Keith, we've been through much the past 11 years. Our lives haven't always been easy, but through it all, our undeniable love for each other has carried us through. I love you. Don't ever forget that. When you're feeling lonely and I'm not home with you, just pull out this letter and read my words to you once again, and know how much you will always mean to me. With loving thoughts of you now and forever, Jeff." I truly believe I have learned the meaning of the phrase, "Love is eternal." Thank you. I am honored to have had this chance to appear before you. Climate change blamed as largest Arctic ice shelf breaks in two after 3,000 years. By Michael McCarthy. The largest ice shelf in the Arctic, a solid feature for at least 3,000 years, has broken in two, and climate change is to blame, say American and Canadian scientists. The Ward Hunt ice shelf on the north coast of Ellesmere Island in Canada has split down the middle, and a freshwater lake held behind it has drained away, the researchers say. Reporting in the journal Geophysical Research Letters, the scientists say the fracture, which had been developing since 2000, was further evidence of continuing and accelerating climate change in the North Polar region. Much evidence suggests that the sea ice covering the Arctic Ocean is rapidly thinning and retreating, with reports 2 years ago that at one stage the North Pole itself was actually seawater rather than ice. The breakup of the ice shelf, floating ice attached to land, shows a relatively rapid temperature rise. The ice, which formed a cap at the end of the 20-mile-long Disraeli Fjord, was the largest remaining piece of an ice shelf that once ran the length of Ellesmere Island. It began to break up 100 years ago, and by 1982, about 90% of it was gone, but it then stabilized over the next two decades, say the scientists Warwick Vincent and Derek Mueller of Laval University in Quebec City, and Martin Jefferies of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. However, in April 2000, satellite images showed the beginnings of cracking from the eastern side of Ward Hunt Island into the fjord, and by 2001 it had split along its length, then widened in 2002 to 85 yards in some places. It has spawned several ice islands, some large enough to endanger shipping and drilling platforms in the Beaufort Sea. A layer of fresh water on the top of the fjord that was dammed by the shelf and contained a unique ecosystem of rare plankton and other life has drained into the Arctic Ocean. The Ward Hunt shelf was up to 100 feet thick, far thicker than the sea ice on the Arctic Ocean surface, which averages 10 feet. The researchers said its disintegration seemed to have been prompted by a century-old local warming trend and a more recent rapid rise in temperatures. They were not certain it was linked to the man-made warming apparently caused by rising concentrations of greenhouse gases, but it was one of many signs the Arctic is seeing enormous climatic changes. "We believe it's part of a long-term process," said Dr. Vincent, a biologist in polar ecology. "But the most recent changes are substantial and correlate with this recent increase in warming seen from the 1960s to the present. A critical threshold has been passed. It is accepted that should the global climate start to warm, the effects would be felt first in the polar regions, and they would be amplified," said Dr. Jeffries, a geophysicist. "This could be part of that signal. Recent records show that there has been a local increase of 0.4 degrees Celsius every decade since 1967. Since then, the average July temperature has been above freezing at 1.3 Celsius. Professor Julian Dowdswell, director of Britain's Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge, said the breakup of Ward Hunt Ice Shelf was not caused by man-made climate change, but by the natural end of a period known as the Little Ice Age. But he said recent changes in sea ice thickness and extent could be manifestations of global warming, and the breakup of Ward Hunt could be part of that pattern. With no plan apparent, GIs in Iraq slowly becoming frantic. By Sergeant Leanne Duffy. I'm a National Guardsman of the 105th Personal Services Detachment out of Lincoln, Nebraska. My unit and I are stationed in Kuwait at Camp Wolf. We were deployed February 2nd. We arrived in Jordan in April, and half of us were moved a week later to Kuwait to throw mail. When our unit came back together in June, we had an order to go home, but it was revoked, and we ended up replacing an active Army unit. When replacing the active unit, we were told our date to go home was December 1st. We now hear that we will be here for a full year. We are under 3rd Personnel Command. They say that when they decide who stays and who goes, it's not by how long soldiers have been deployed, just by unit necessity. My unit processes incoming soldiers and helps soldiers redeploy for theater. We're doing a great job and are working hard to treat each soldier with care and consideration as they come past our desks. They have spread our 44 soldiers out to replace an active unit that had over 50 and to replace a National Guard unit that had over 60 soldiers. Not only are we running 24-hour operations 7 days a week for these two units, but we have 4 of our soldiers on the redeployment side working validation for another unit. We're spread so thin and are working so hard that these knocks on our morale are devastating. Yet we are physically able to finish our mission, but mentally and spiritually we are dying. If retention for the Army National Guard is of any importance, current members need to have faith in our government and our leaders. Right now where we are, we can't see anyone taking a stand for the soldiers, as it isn't just us being treated this way, but many, many soldiers. This isn't a simple board game of Axis and Allies. This is a game people are playing with real people, people with families, not robots. You have college students out here, like me, missing over a year of college to sit and get yanked around without explanation. It has been told to the officers I have spoken to that 3rd PERSCOM refers to moving soldiers as drug deals. You do this for me, and I'll make sure your soldiers go home, etc. Yes, without a doubt, my duty is to serve my country despite her faults. I have learned I will not be able to get education and training services while I'm here, and I'm accepting that. I'm here to serve out of obligation and duty. What I'm wondering is if there are any checks and balances for those who are making decisions here. Everyone keeps saying it is up in the air, including the personnel responsible for deciding who is going where. It feels as if every decision is made off the cuff. In this situation, there should be plans in place and decisions made before the rubber hits the road. We're slowly becoming frantic. I hear people saying they're going to begin hurting themselves or others if they can't go home. The helplessness our soldiers are feeling is indescribable. It is past the point of suck it up and drive on. We just want somewhere to drive on to. Thank you for allowing me to bend your ear. Poll finds 89% of U.S. consumers want GE food more strictly regulated. By Mike Lee. Even as genetically modified crops continue to spread across the globe, Americans appear to know less about biotech foods than they did 2 years ago, and much of what they do know is wrong, according to nationwide survey results being released today. Research for the Pew Initiative on Food and Biotechnology found that even though an estimated 3/4 of processed food on grocery store shelves contains genetically engineered ingredients, only 24% of survey respondents believe they had eaten such food. Nearly half opposed introducing biotech foods into the nation's food supply, something that was done years ago. It's obvious that people are confused and many people are troubled about genetically engineered foods, said Ronnie Cummins, national director of the Organic Consumers Association in Minnesota. But it's also clear that they are not learning much from the media in their everyday lives. The survey conducted in August also shows that resistance to biotech foods is lessening, but the consumer opinions about the safety of those products remain as deeply divided as they were in Pew's baseline 2001 survey. Among its clearest conclusions, however, was that consumers want the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to take a more active role regulating genetically engineered foods. About a decade after the first biotech foods were introduced, the industry remains largely self-regulated on questions of food safety. Most consumers don't know anything about government regulation, according to the new survey, but they aren't comfortable with the FDA's voluntary consultation program that allows companies to submit only a research summary. A very strong 89% of the respondents supported the idea that the FDA should have a mandatory process under which they find that genetically engineered foods are safe before they can be marketed, said Michael Rodemeyer, executive director of the Pew Initiative in Washington, D.C. Those findings were in sync with a report issued last year by the U.S. General Accounting Office, which suggested that the FDA's evaluation process for biotech foods could be enhanced by randomly verifying the test data from companies. Jim Mariansky, biotechnology coordinator for foods at the FDA, declined to discuss the Pew study but characterized the GAO's recommendation as reasonable, even though the agency has yet to make the changes. "We're quite confident that the system in place is one that is working very well, that it protects consumers' health," Mariansky said. "Companies are continuing to use the system of consultation with the FDA." The underlying theme of the Pew survey was that the public remains ill-informed about a technology being used to enhance crops on 145 million acres worldwide, and one that is being touted as a promising new way to grow lower-cost pharmaceutical compounds and plants. Knowledge of genetically modified foods actually decreased since 2001. Only 34% of respondents to this year's poll had heard some or a great deal about the food, compared to 44% in the earlier survey. The Melman Group, which surveyed 1,000 American consumers, theorized that knowledge about biotech food was higher in 2001 because that survey was conducted right after a widely publicized mistake in which genetically engineered corn, called Starlink, intended only for feed corn, was mixed into corn products such as taco shells. "We still have a long way to go on education in science and technology," said Judith Kjellstrom, acting director of the University of California, Davis, biotechnology program. Kjellstrom said information from the industry appears to be helping reduce negative opinions about genetic engineering. "It takes people time to get used to new technology," she said, adding that Americans tend to worry about more pressing issues, such as war and the economy, while assuming trusted federal agencies will protect them from dangerous foods. Corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton account for the vast majority of commercialized biotech crops, which are designed to withstand herbicides or resist pests. Biotech opponents, a few thousand of whom protested at an international conference on agricultural technology held in Sacramento this summer, fear that messing around with genes will ultimately hurt human health and the environment. Nonetheless, opposition to using biotech ingredients in U.S. foods dropped 10 percentage points between the surveys, heartening Lisa J. Dry at the Biotechnology Industry Organization in Washington, D.C. "Technology opponents have worked very hard to make people fearful, and they haven't been able to get any traction on that because the science and our experience with these foods don't support their arguments," Dry said. Tom Hoban, a sociology professor at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, said he has been urging biotech and food companies to make it clear that genetically engineered foods are already part of our food chain. That, Hoban said, would avoid charges of deception if any future problems arise. But as long as the industry can avoid another contamination problem, such as Starlink, Hoban said the lack of consumer knowledge found in the survey may work well for those companies developing products that target consumers instead of farmers. Monsanto, for instance, is working on plants high in heart-healthy oils. "What industry and others have kind of hoped," Hoban said, "is that they could kind of keep genetically engineered foods under the radar screen until there are some consumer benefits. Americans are iffy on genetically modified foods." GE soybeans have been a disaster in Argentina. From Biotechnology and the Origins of the Argentine Catastrophe by Eduardo Ruoli de Jorge. Coexistence does not work. GE crops cause environmental and social problems. Minister Marion Hobbs told the Organic Producers Rally at Parliament this week that Argentina was a wonderful example of coexistence, maintained diversity and harmony between the GE and organic industry. This is refuted by Lillian Johnson, biologist, PhD, molecular biologist, who says, "In reality, GM soy has been planted on 13 million hectares of land. It has destroyed forests and replaced traditional food crops. It has destroyed the biodiversity and led to the agony of 1,000 rural communities. Crop spraying has been carried out using glyphosate with additives of 24D and paraquat. This has polluted the water supplies, causing health problems to the citizens." Producers have become leasers of their own land, causing an emigration of rural workers. Almost 300,000 people have been expelled from their land, and over 13 million have impeded mortgages. Coexistence has polluted traditional maize in Mexico, regardless of a GE ban. How can anybody say that Argentina has been a success? Argentina started to plant Roundup Ready soya in 1997, and now we have 13 million hectares of RR soya. Between 95 and 99% of all soya in Argentina is now RR soya, she says. Organic soya is imported to Argentina. I know small farmers who had real problems with keeping a few hectares for organic soya farming, so they just gave up. They had to go to RR soya. A list of the resistant weeds to glyphosate that those who promoted RR soya have detailed themselves. Camellia erecta, Convolvulus arvensis, bindweed, Ipomoea purpurea, morning glory, Erycine diffusa, erycine, Hybanthus parafloris, violetea, Parietaria debilis, pellitory, Viola arvensis, violet wild, Petunia axillaris, petunia, Verbena, Tripoba chogan, goat's beard, Senecio pampeanus, ragwort, and Taraxacum officinale, dandelion. Chemicals now adapted in control of third-generation GE crops and resistant weeds include 2,4-D, 2,4-DB, paraquat, atrazine, paraquat metzulfuron methyl, imazathafur. The insects that attack RR soya monoculture in Argentina are Nizara viridula, Piazzodorus guildini, Edessa meditabunda, Dichelops fricatus. In order to fight them, they use endosulfan together with cypermethrin and air fumigation, also glyphosate and the other herbicides. Endosulfan and cypermethrin together are extremely toxic to bees, fishes, and birds. The poverty that has befallen Argentina through the introduction of crops reliant on agrochemicals has caused a catastrophe that need not be repeated in New Zealand. GE-free New Zealand and Food and Environment calls on the government to keep GE contained in laboratories. Our small country cannot cope with more biosecurity and chemical pollution problems. Only sustainable agriculture can feed the planet. By Felicity Lawrence. British governments don't like telling us what to eat these days. Whether on the left or the right, they fear it smacks of the nanny state. While a government may advise, it is not seen as its business to do more. What we eat is a matter of individual choice. Where politics does tangle with food, governments put it down to the unfortunate legacy of previous interventions from which they wish to withdraw, such as subsidies and other barriers to the efficient working of a global market. By this argument, decisions about the future of genetically modified organisms are not political, but scientific and economic, a matter of dispassionately and independently weighing the evidence on safety and assessing the benefits against the risks. This position is, of course, not apolitical. It is, in fact, highly political. It is also the wrong sort of politics, monetarist, myopic, and dangerous, as Colin Tudge's important new book makes clear. A failure to acknowledge that food is about politics leaves governments floundering before the epidemics of obesity and other diet-related diseases which are overtaking industrialized nations. It leaves them unable to tackle the real causes of foodborne illness, as the American academic Marian Nestle and the eminent British government advisor Professor Hugh Pennington show in their books. Nestle gives an excellent analysis of the shortcomings of the science-based approach to food. It asks, how big is this risk? Does it outweigh any benefit? But this leaves out other vital factors based on values. Who is imposing the risk and who is taking it? Are the risks being taken by one group, the public, and the benefits accruing to another, the industry? Pennington's detailed reconstruction of the E. coli outbreak in Scotland in 1996 and the origins of bovine spongiform encephalopathy make clear how much is at stake. It also makes an important contribution to the growing revisionist debate about whether eating infected meat is really the cause of BSE and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Nestle gives equally revelatory accounts of how economic imperatives overrode the public interest when traces of genetically modified corn, not licensed for human food, were found in food on American supermarket shelves. Nestle and Pennington both report from the coalface of government advisory work. Tudge's book offers a deep, broader sweep which puts our food system in its historical and philosophical context. He has published some of the ideas before, but this is the magnum opus, and it is a huge and significant work, a wake-up call to politicians who are fiddling while our prospects of survival burn. His thesis is that if we carry on with our current system of food production, the chances of humanity lasting through the next 100 years are rather slim. It is possible to feed the world, but we don't farm to do that. Instead, agriculture is now treated as though it were like any other business, and is being given over to what he describes as an extreme form of capitalism, which is monetarist, industrialist, corporatist, globalist. MICG for short. He no longer has any quarrel with capitalism per se. Nothing else works, he argues, but this extreme form in which companies have grown into giant corporations so powerful they are able to override the societies that give rise to them is pernicious. The big question is, can we feed the world? The traditional view, going back to Malthus, has been that agriculture will not be able to keep pace with exploding world population and that we will be overtaken by famine and biological collapse. The introduction of GMOs is now being justified on precisely these grounds, that they will help feed the world. And now appears that the global population will stabilize around the year 2050 at about 10 billion, and will then decline again. There will be a period of demographic winter lasting 500 to 1,000 years, when it will be touch and go as to whether we can feed ourselves, but then things will get better. There will also be the small matter of how to employ all these extra millions of people as we all get older. 2050 is not so very far off. In other words, this enormous issue will have to be faced in the lifetime of most of us. We could feed the world and escape this threat, but not if we continue to farm in the current way. We would have to return to a more traditional form of mixed farming. By a series of dazzling calculations, which take in the history of agriculture and the evolution of man, Tudd shows that there is enough land to grow the staples for the world population at its peak, and to provide a mixed diet, fruit and vegetables and small quantities of meat, which delivers our other nutritional requirements. But there is not enough global capacity to support a population whose eating habits are being pushed by commerce in the opposite direction. Take meat. The global drive is to raise livestock in the greatest numbers. Keeping a few animals is efficient. Cellulose is a cornucopia of food available in nature in billions of tons in the form of plants. Humans cannot digest it, but animals can. We can get the benefit of this food source by eating them. Animals can also make use of otherwise unproductive land, such as uplands. But in excess, meat is bad for us, and too many animals become a drain on resources. Livestock today consume a third of the world's wheat, two-thirds of the maize, and at least three-quarters of the barley and soya. That's enough nutrition for an extra 2 billion people. By 2050, if current trends continue, livestock will be consuming more food than was consumed in 1970 by the entire human population. Mixed farming, in which livestock and crops are properly balanced, works because it marches to the drum of biology. It modifies nature, but also mirrors it. Animals eat plants and return material to their soil and their manure, in forms that the plants can in turn feed on. In other words, it is sustainable and it minimizes disease. Why do we farm so perversely? Because everything in agriculture, as elsewhere, is translated into money. Efficiency is measured solely in cash terms. Efficiency is achieved by reducing the cost of inputs. Livestock are a way of making more money out of staples. The greatest input in traditional agriculture is labor, so labor must be cut. The farmer in Lincolnshire can now run 2,000 hectares with just one employee. But if you cut labor, you have to simplify husbandry. You can't have mixed farming, which requires people. Monoculture, with farms run by numbers with routine applications of chemicals, are what one man and his 2,000 acres can manage. You're inevitably drawn into a cycle of industrialization. Other concerns, social, moral, do not even get onto the balance sheet because you cannot measure them in cash terms. Reducing the agricultural workforce to almost zero is not only the policy pursued by politicians in the West, it is one they seek to impose on developing countries. Even if you choose to be blind to the long-term prospects for humanity, the immediate dangers are obvious. Half the world is starving, while the other half suffers from disease of excess. Epidemics of animal disease become inevitable too. Foot and mouth and BSE, recently, are the result of what Tudge calls bad husbandry. This is also the objection to GMOs. They are worrying for biological reasons because the risks are unknowable. They contribute nothing truly worthwhile to wheat, rice, and maize, which account for half of all human calories and most of the protein. But the greatest threat they present is political, by helping to create a world in which agriculture becomes the domain of big business. Science has, in this sense, been corrupted. Instead of supporting an agriculture which is in step with nature, it seeks to override nature. Tudge, a zoologist by training and fellow at the Center of Philosophy at the London School of Economics, combines an eclectic mind with analytical powers and the humane sweep of a political philosopher. Unlike many opponents of GMOs, he can argue the detailed scientific case, but he also has a wonderful eye for anecdote. I, for one, didn't know that the panic on horses' faces in Greek statues was due to the fact that before the invention of the soft horse collar by the Chinese, harnesses were tied around the horse's neck, so the more the animal pulled, the more it was throttled. Congress debates labeling and choice over irradiated foods in schools. Washington, September 17th. Statement of Winoa Hauder, Director of Public Citizens Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program. Today's announcement by Representative Barbara Lee, that she will sponsor a right-to-know bill on irradiated food in the National School Lunch Program, is a giant step forward for consumers in the emerging public debate about irradiation. The bill would mandate the distribution of balanced information about irradiated foods used in school lunch programs, require all irradiated food to be clearly labeled, and ensure that school districts, parents, and students retain the option of choosing non-irradiated foods. Her efforts will greatly empower parents and children who rely on the Federal Nutrition Program. Current regulations state that irradiated food doesn't need to be labeled if it's served in schools, hospitals, or restaurants. Therefore, children and their parents will not know if the food served on school lunch trays has been irradiated. Representative Lee's bill seeks to change that, and rightfully so. It is vital for parents to know what their children are eating. They deserve balanced information, not slick industry propaganda about what irradiation does to food. Moreover, the children most likely to eat food purchased through the school lunch program are from lower-income families that cannot afford to send their children to school with homemade lunches. These children depend on food provided by government nutrition programs. If irradiated meat ends up on their lunch trays at schools, they don't have the option of saying no. Studies show significant opposition to irradiated food and concern about the lack of labeling of it. One notable group that seems consistently to have serious reservations about food irradiation is women with school-aged children. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration held 6 focus groups during the summer of 2001 in which consumers were asked their opinions of labeling for irradiated foods. In its report to Congress, the FDA stated that everyone agreed that irradiated food should be labeled honestly. As this bill moves through Congress, we urge government officials to respect parental choice and consumers' right to information. Congress should keep in mind that the U.S. Department of Agriculture approved irradiated food in the school lunch program despite significant opposition from parents and teachers across the country. In fact, 93% of the thousands of comments submitted to the USDA opposed the proposal to permit irradiated food in school cafeterias. Congress should listen to its constituents and pass this bill so parents can make informed choices about what their children are eating at school. You have been listening to Lover Alternative News.